Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our suite of ops community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's May 1st, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator focused on funded startups and enterprises and teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 plus Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. If you're curious about seeing if we can move the needle for you, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So with that said, let's just jump right into announcements for today. Here are some things that caught my eye. One was trending on Hacker News just a few minutes ago. I really thought this was an interesting one, one that might elicit some conversation. We have talked about this previously on Office Hours, more last year than this year. But the question is, how do you properly assess and fairly assess the skill level of candidates applying for your jobs? You want to be mindful and respectful of their time. But you know, if you've ever been on the other side of the table as a hiring manager, you are inundated with resumes, buzzwords, keywords, seldom cover letters. And you know, how do you weed through that? And there's a lot of people, a lot of engineers who are also very accomplished at talking the talk, but they can't always walk the walk. There's also the elements of working with those people that, you know, you won't know until you actually have a project with them. So doing take-home assessments is something more and more companies are doing. What I thought was really interesting about this was, here's somebody who went through and researched some 200 public take-homes and assessments and kind of distilled it down to some of the commonalities that he found. You know, on average, it seemed like, you know, about 3 hours is expected to complete one of these assessments. However, to be competitive, you know, you might need to spend 6 hours, like if you want to outshine anybody else doing the same type of assessment. He also talks about how, you know, implicitly there's some competitive advantage here when, you know, you're younger, because you don't yet maybe have family and kids when you would take that 3 hours to do an assessment after work. So I thought that was also an interesting point. He talks about that, you know, many assessments are designed to be open-ended, which is what we deliberately do in our assessments at Cloud Posse. Is I want to see the candidate come back and say that something is not properly scoped, or say that, you know, it's unclear. But you know what happens so often? People are afraid to ask the questions. I don't know why. And then they just go off on some tangent implementing it. And then when you say, well, you know, that's not right. And they might say something like, well, you didn't say what you should do on the job rec, or, you know, in the take home. Exactly. Right. Exactly. That's what we want to. We want to see that you're a self-starter. We want to see that you have built in circuit breakers when things aren't wrong. So one of the ideas I really liked in one of these suggestions here, and I'm not sure exactly where it was asking the candidate to actually first scope the work. And I thought that was really interesting, because if they scope the work and they scope it for more than 3 hours, and we said it was 3 hours, that's great. Now, you know, then, well, how can we break that work down into a smaller unit? Or if they scope it for less, but they end up spending 6 hours and then they complain, you know, then it's fair. I guess my point is that that's total transparency there. If you first ask the candidate to scope that work and the task, possibly deliberately increasing the scope so that, you know, they can say what part of that would be achievable in some time box. I think that's a really interesting idea I'd never thought about before. I'll pause there. Anybody have any thoughts on this? Possibly see this article. Matt, I know you've had a lot of opinions on this in the past, so.
Yeah, my opinions for some reason always seem like unpopular, but my with respect to this, but my thing is, giving someone a take home exercise seems reasonable. Like, it seems reasonable for you to, like, the thing that, like, okay, let's just say now we're not in, we're not in the craziness of everyone is a remote worker and everything else. Like, so rewind a couple of years. If I said to you, hey, we were interested in moving you to the next round, come into the Matco headquarters office for a day, and we're going to put you through a series of interviews to see if you can, you're a fit. No one blinks an eye, right? They'd be like, okay, no problem. I'll schedule a day off and I'll come in and do my interviews with you. But then the minute when you say, when you the minute you say, like, here, I want to give you something that you can do, not under the scrutiny of our users, not, on any time pressure, whatever fits into your schedule, and we expect you to take a few hours to do it, people start losing their minds, which I don't quite understand. Like, it seems like just counterintuitive to me. Like, and it doesn't seem like it's different. So I've seen the argument where some people will say, actually pick up a task from our backlog and, like, do it as a take home exam. And there are lots of reasons that I understand why that could be helpful, but also could be hurtful. But in the thing where you're giving out a rubric where everyone is evaluated by the same take home exam that you're supposed to work on for some period of time that you feel is necessary to demonstrate your skills, it seems like a reasonable ask to me, but I don't know. Like, but I see, like, I see reactions right here, like, ooh, pay me first. But, like, why, my opinion on the other hand is, like, it's different. Like, if you're an open source contributor and you have, like, a ton of stuff you can point to and be like, here, go look at my GitHub. I have, like, hundreds of examples of the code I can write and the quality I can do it, and all those kinds of things, then maybe you have an argument. But if you're kind of, like, completely an unknown off the street, I don't know how else, how else an organization can really interpret how you're going to take a requirement, some directions, and then, like, what the output is from that. It seems like a reasonable ask. To me, I don't know.
One of the situations for that that they address here that they saw were sometimes offering donations to a charity of your choice. Based, one was like $400 if you're hired, $200 if you were, a runner up, so to say. I thought that was an interesting one without, direct compensation, but showing that you are willing to put some skin in the game as an employer.
Just to quickly add on to that, we so on my team, when we've been hiring or posting out recs, we've done this approach where we tell people we have an exam or we have some tests, but we've never actually given that. And as part of that, telling people that we have a test, we offer compensation alongside that. So whether it's creating this thing in Terraform, whatever that test might look like, we have an idea of what that is. And we'll usually. We're under five employees, so it maybe, and it's all contract based, so we usually do ask for hourly rates. And the responses have been pretty good. We've usually found high quality candidates responding to our job postings. We usually have, like, an hour long conversation with them, and we just consider that a free one. We don't pay them for that. And then if we were to ask them to do anything else or do another interview, we've always set the expectation that we would pay them. And yeah, that seems to be working out pretty well for us. We haven't done this to mass scale. We're still sub five contractors, but ask me again maybe in a year. I'll have a better answer of how that scales. But
Cool. Do you have a Calendly link? I want to interview with you. I'd like some coffee.
yeah. Yeah, we don't. We
That's kind of the problem, right?
oh yeah. So we don't pay for the first call by any means. We pay for additional if we're actually asking them to do any work. Maybe that's a take-home test or spinning up the stack. As you might imagine, there are a number of applications that do come in where you're like, why did this person apply?
Yeah, of course. But I was only being, I'm being somewhat like, snarky about it. But like, if you end up paying, like, if you end up paying everyone to do anything, it gets into a slippery slope. Like at that point, to me, like there should be the way I look at it is if you're going to enter a partnership where this is your career for some period of time in the future, like both parties should invest in making sure that you're right fit in both directions. Like that the employee is the right fit for the employer, but also the employer is the right fit for the employee. In there. And these kinds of exercises are actually really good ways to see, like, well, how are they going to give me tasks? How are they going to give me feedback? How are they going to review my code? All of that. Like it's just as good for you as it is for the employer to narrow down the people that can't complete the exercises like to their level of expectation, that kind of thing. So, and I think we had a bunch of comments going along in the chat over here, but one of the ones that I mentioned, or I'm agreeing with what Aaron was saying, is that I in my opinion, these types of take-home tests should be the last step before you kind of make an offer. Like you go through all your interviews, like any hypotheticals, like whatever you want to do there, and then that should be the last step. You shouldn't be like, okay, first step in the door, go do these things, and then we'll weed everyone down based on that. Like managers should have to do like some work to try to narrow down candidates that seem qualified by having conversations with them and everything. And I think that addresses what Alex said a little bit earlier. And then like and unfortunately, Alex, what your point is, like I feel like I've done a pretty good job over my 20 plus year career, like identifying talent and hiring some pretty solid engineers. And there have been some people that have fooled me in conversation only styles, and not until finger has to touch keyboard do you realize like they're really good at theory but really bad at like making the rubber hit the road and actually getting something done. And on many, I shouldn't say many, but on several occasions I can think of, giving them like a real world example has actually helped me realize that they're not the right fit for a position, even when I thought they were a great candidate after my conversations with them. So yeah, I don't know. So those are just my thoughts.
Yeah, I think, in 2020 hindsight, in some of those situations, one could see, well, that's because I didn't ask XYZ or something. But there's something to be said about it's like integration testing, where you can't test every scenario, but by the act of testing some, you implicitly test for a whole bunch of other types of failure cases. And how annoying isn't it, wouldn't it be to go through 200 questionnaires just to make sure every single thing is checked off the box? To the most co okay, most common is an exaggeration. It's happened twice, and it's on me. I take responsibility as a hiring manager in this case. But what happened? Like, everything seemed fine. They could talk the talk, they understood the theory, as Matt says. They had experience, they'd worked at these companies. And then we assigned them a task. One of them opened a pull request to one of our public repositories with something like, hiring homework exercise or whatever it was, and had their complete solution as a pull request modifying one of our open source modules. That was really weird. And I would have never suspected that would have been the problem. I've had other situations where, honestly, maybe they hadn't been using, maybe they hadn't just been working in a mature capacity doing code. Like, they couldn't even do pull requests. And like, I, so now it's like, but when you talk to anybody senior, I don't even, it's almost like beneath, like, You do know how to make open a pull request, right, Matt? Like if we're gonna do this, right? Yeah, that seems a little bit belittling, or like I wouldn't even think to ask that. It's just taken for granted. So that's a pretty low bar, by the way. All right.
Yeah. Or I'll give another quick example. In one coding, like one coding thing, I gave someone, they had to write like several different functions to do this different thing. And instead of calling the same function multiple times, this person like copied and pasted the code like seven different times, like the same exact code. And that led me to be like theory wise, they understood it really well. But then I was like, why didn't you just like refactor this out into a function? Like, okay, if it was in there twice, maybe like that, he realized, okay, well, I don't want to take the time to do this right now. But it was literally like seven times he called the same thing and copied and pasted the same exact code seven times. And I was like, so in the code review with him, I was like, hey, did you consider like refactoring this into another function? Because it appears seven times in your code. And he was like, oh, he's like, oh, yeah, I guess that probably makes sense. And it was just like, I was thinking to myself, like, how did that not scream at you when you're copying and pasting, like, that kind of thing. So it was like really, I don't know. It was really like confusing to me. So it led to more conversation about like refactoring and, how they go about working and that kind of thing. So anyway, I've talked enough about it, but I think it helps in both directions.
Matt, I have this
And
weird thing where,
sorry,
when go
can
ahead.
I add just one 30, like not even 30 seconds, but I'll also say trying to get hired somewhere, I had a take-home test like this, and I realized I absolutely did not want to work there by the pull request comments I got back from whoever reviewed my pull request. And I was like, I could never work with these people. First, one of them was suggesting that something I did was like wrong, and I knew that it was right, and I explained why it was right. And then he wrote back something like, well, that's not the way we do it here, so you'll just have to learn, or something like that. And I was like, oh, okay. And then the other person was just like really rude in their comments, and I was just like, if this is how you treat coworkers, I definitely don't want to work. I definitely do not want to work on this team. So like, I was like, thanks, but no thanks. Close the pull request. Went home. So.
Yeah, it goes both ways. It's really to benefit. A good exam is really, or take home like this is really benefiting both parties. If they're doing it seriously. And if you don't see it that way, then maybe consider, like, maybe it's not the right company, or maybe, like, ask how this might be improved. I think as an employer, as somebody hiring, I want to see somebody thinking critically, who's valuing themselves and their time, but doing so constructively, and standing on their own. All right. Next one was a different, oops, this was, here we go. Was a different type of write-up. Everyone, there's been a lot of talk about IBM buying HashiCorp, but let's talk about who didn't buy HashiCorp. So I thought this was kind of an interesting analysis to that point. They go into, like, why wouldn't Google maybe have acquired IBM, IBM, no, acquired HashiCorp. And that, they kind of walk through, some of Google's history in this area, bringing up the recent news that Google just laid off their entire Python team, a signal that, they are really tightening their focus on where they are investing. Another interesting one is when you think about Terraform, and you think about all the providers that they support and how much investment goes into that, a lot by HashiCorp, especially the official ones. Now, if you're Google, do you really want to be investing that much in the AWS provider? Now, granted, the AWS provider has a lot of support from AWS themselves, but that's just one example. And there are plenty of other providers which that could be less. when really they're mostly concerned about that provider's functionality as it relates to their cloud, like Google Cloud. Let's see what else was standing out, if I remember. And in the end, yeah, Google gets, all the benefit of that open source without really needing to commit. Has anyone else seen the article? Any other points they want to bring out? All right. Next
Just
announcement. Yep.
on that same topic, though, I'd be very interested to see what IBM does with the HashiCorp products. I've done a pretty good amount of just thinking about all this and reasoning and that kind of thing, and I wonder if this isn't like a huge, like this isn't an enabler to get more people to try to use IBM Cloud at the end of the day, like which is, which they obviously they're like a far distant, competitor to all the other major cloud providers, but hybrid cloud and using like specific things that are on IBM and giving them an easy way to get onto IBM and run workloads securely and all of that kind of thing, in a hybrid cloud with IBM being one of those hybrid, hybrid cloud environments. It would be interesting to see like if they even charge for HashiCorp products going forward, or if that's just a an enablement purchase to try to sell more of their cloud, their cloud product. So I don't know anything, inside information or anything. I'm just speculating out loud that maybe that's the case.
I think that would be one of the best possible outcomes here. I'm hoping they are purchasing it as an enablement play and giving them first class there. Yeah. There was also talk related to the hybrid stuff and Google and why Google is maybe not investing as much in the hybrid stuff, but I don't remember the details. Anyway. Next topic. There's been more and more of these type announcements. I think a lot of the major Linux distros have dropped HashiCorp as a package. GitLab removed their GitHub Actions that were supporting Terraform and Homebrew.
It was not GitLab, GitHub Actions, but workflows, GitLab
Oh, GitLab. Yeah, did I say GitHub? Yeah, I
workflows. Yeah, you
meant.
said GitHub Actions, GitLab's GitHub Actions. I was
Yeah.
like, wait, what?
No, I totally misspoke there. Yeah, not GitHub yet, but more on that later. GitLab deprecated any
Workflows.
of their native workflows for Terraform proper, Terraform HashiCorp licensed Terraform, and they only support OpenTofu now. And now Homebrew dropping their official package. Obviously, you can probably still find a cask somewhere, which is not an official package. It's just that it's not part of the core.
I mean, any commercially licensed products are like that now through Homebrew anyway, so that's not that surprising.
Yeah, that makes sense. So another interesting post that has gotten tremendous circulation over the past week was somebody who had the unfortunate luck to get an S3 bucket that was referenced in some major project out there. I think it was a Node.js project or something. It wasn't disclosed, but I'm guessing sleuths on Reddit have already figured it out somewhere. And they incurred, like, within, was it like hours or minutes, thousands of dollars worth of AW S3 spend before they turned it off. Somehow this bucket also had write permission to it. So yeah, public write access to
Oh, Actually, it didn't. That was how it all started out. So the whole thing that they discovered was that 4xx responses to S3 buckets were being charged to owners of the bucket.
Oh, okay.
Like that's actually the major complaint to this was that when you had misconfiguration. So this bucket, they chose the name that was the default bucket name for a backup of some popular service for like this thing could back up to an S3 bucket, and they happened to choose the right name for that whatever was the default. And then everyone that had this package installed but hadn't ever configured backups on it tried to back up to this thing like immediately because it now existed. The API returned a four, like a 403, and all those 403 requests actually get counted as requests on AWS. And that's actually and you can see that it's S3 charges for unauthorized incoming requests. And they confirm that with AWS support, and that is the case. But I have seen since then that Jeff Barr commented on it that this caught his attention. He took it to the right people, and they will shortly be fixing this so that customers don't have to get charged for unauthorized requests to their bucket. So they are going to deal with it. But then in the meantime, the guy said he then purposely opened up read write access on his bucket to see what was being where all these requests were coming from. And he
Okay.
said he then got the backups of like all these different people's whatever software this is into his bucket. And he said in a few minutes he got like 10 gigs worth of data like uploaded to his bucket so that he turned it off again because he didn't want to get charged for like some
Okay.
crazy amount of data.
Okay. 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 Wow.
Yeah. So you could see there 100 million pull requests within a day.
Insane.
So it's pretty crazy.
And that was basically, and that was basically $1,300 within that short time period as well.
Within a day. Yeah.
Wow. So
And it takes a lot to actually get charged like that much for S3. S3 is like super cheap, right? So to get charged 1300 for S3, that's what I mean, he's telling you he had 100 million denied S3 put requests in less than 24 hours. So that's crazy.
and I mean, he must have at least had budgets enabled, or for some reason was looking at the billing dashboard. I could so much, I could totally predict this going a different way,
Oh,
where.
he didn't. He got lucky. He said whatever the work he was doing was, he wanted to make sure that he was still staying within the free tier like limits of what he was doing. So he just happened to check his bill, and his bill was like
So that's
$1,300 or
basically what
something.
I mean. He got lucky. Like, I think most people go and provision an S3 bucket who've done this for the last, 10 years. Unless you're uploading a petabyte of data, you don't even think twice about the cost of that bucket. You just provision it and forget it. So this could have easily been a $30,000, $40,000 mistake. All right.
Oh, and that was the other interesting part that he said. So his bucket was in EU West 1, and the other reason it stood out to him is because all the 400 or 4xx errors were coming from S3 in US East 1, because apparently they reply out of US East 1 as is the default region if you have like whatever, and then it automatically redirects you to the right region where the bucket exists. So you said he was getting some sort of extra charge, yeah, for the redirected request because they were requesting it in US East 1 instead of US or instead of Europe, whatever it was, EU West 1 or whatever. So he got like he said he also saw like charges in US East 1, and he's like, how's that possible? I'm not even using US East 1. So yeah, there you go. 10 gigs in 30 seconds.
10 gigs in 30 seconds uploaded. That's insane. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Next one. So, I think I probably knew this at some point or I've seen it somewhere, but it is a good reminder and it is pretty cool that if you look at any pull request, and you just add, this happens to redirect here, so that was less interesting. Let me copy link URL. So if I open a new link here, so if I just go to that pull request, it looks like normal, right? And if I just add .diff or .patch, I'll get the corresponding formatted raw output. And this is really interesting, especially if you have a local checkout of the code, there's somebody's pull request you want to try and apply to your local version to see if it fixes something you're working on. This is a great way to apply that patch then. Also easy just to look, using curl, you can just view it on the command line very easily as well. All right, not more than that. This was interesting, I thought. I've been looking a little bit more at, half-assed about how we can try and improve sponsorships at Cloud Posse. I think we have 25 sponsors right now. God bless you. Thank you. But we need a lot more. And I'm wondering how we can sweeten the pot, make it more valuable to sponsor, aside from the fact that we already gave away all the code. So I saw two things that I wasn't fully aware of before. So maybe others don't know it as well. So they support in a tier, you can offer repository private access to a repository. So that's interesting. So if you have some way of if there's something you're holding back and you want to make it available, you can offer a sponsorship tier where when they sponsor, their GitHub username is automatically added to that repository as a collaborator. Now, there's a downside. It's on an individual basis. So even if an organization, I believe, sponsors, I guess it's not going to work if an organization sponsors. It says that it's not supported by organizations. So I guess it's A, only supported by individuals, and that's going to heavily, limit the kinds of things you could start distributing that way. But I am really curious because yeah, so organizations that sponsor you are not invited to the repository because there's no concept of that, right? There's no GitHub construct for adding a everyone in an organization as a collaborator to a repository.
Yeah. I mean, if they did that, they would fix so many like GitHub permission problems that people have all over the place, I'm sure.
Yeah.
If you could add organizations or cross organization teams to repositories, that would
Oh,
be
yeah,
awesome.
IAM, right? We need IAM for GitHub, and GitHub has become a source, a cloud of sorts for source code. I think it's about time that they probably go that route, as it becomes more and more, it continues to become more and more the de facto platform.
If you were to implement something like this, it looks like it takes up a seat on your plan. So I would assume the minimum donation for it to make sense would be obviously 20 a month on the low end, right?
Right. Adding insult to injury, right? Yeah. So really, I mean, all right. It was probably not a hard sell internally. Hey, this is just, printing money for us if we enable this. It still doesn't get the open source company any move the needle for them at all. And yeah, if you're an open source company using GitHub Enterprise, those seats aren't cheap.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever donated more than 10 a month for any projects that I've sponsored. And that's obviously because I'm across a number of different projects or what, like there's a lot of different projects I end up using, but it feels a little hard to do 20. I mean, for Cloud Posse, that actually is pretty cheap, but for like the one-off project of that you're just using, you want to sponsor, it's like I don't know about 20.
Oh,
But
no. Yeah, and I understand that. It feels hypocritical as well for me. But we depend on a lot of open source. That 20 or that I think we get about $90 a month in sponsorships. Would easily go 10x that to all the open source that we depend on ourselves. I think from an individual sponsorship perspective, I don't have huge hopes that the number goes up above 10, 25, 30 is amazing, but even then it's probably not in perpetuity. Then it's probably just for a few months or 6 months or something like that. For organizations though, I think the expectation could be a lot higher and should be a lot higher.
Yeah, I've come across a number of projects where I see someone sponsoring 500 or 1,000 a month for something like there's an alternative to Atmos for the GitHub workflow or the Terraform workflows or like GitHub Actions, someone sponsoring that person like 1,000 a month, I think, to basically keep working on those actions, which I'm like, that's pretty cool. It's a way to make it sustainable.
Is
Ideally,
it
they get
the
10 to
D?
20 of them.
Is it the D? I forget. I just know the username begins with the
Yeah,
D.
look. Yeah, the DF look, that guy. He's
Getting
getting like
by. Power to you, bro. Power
a
to you. Because that's 10x what we get. Oh, man. All right.
to be honest, I didn't real I don't know if it was publicly available on your GitHub, but I'm actually a little surprised you're only getting 90 a month. I thought you'd get you folks would be getting a lot more.
And I mean, I don't have delusions right now that we could, operate fully as open source and sponsorships or some, but it would be nice to feel like there is some, that there's some punch behind it because, at $90 a month, it's 30 minutes of our time. And we still have tens of thousands of stars. We have like, we have lots of repositories. I think we have 15,000 merged pull requests, and yeah, other things. So
So,
next.
Eric, I think that you mentioned this, and maybe it was Jeremy White who brought it up. But that T protocol, the like
Oh, right.
blockchain project surrounding supporting open source. I know that it's a stretch because it's like, hey, yeah, we don't want to be involved in, or like I personally look at it as like getting involved in dApps or like anything that's like blockchain just has this barrier to entry that just feels like it's a pain in the ass. And I think it's t.xyz.
Yeah, I forget what it was. Yeah, this one.
Yeah. This, I know that this isn't a perfect solution because, hey, we haven't figured out the usability of blockchain, right? Like it's just not a, it's not a well-established enough technology that is there yet, but this feels like it should be something that cloud posse should sign up for at least and like get the organization involved in, because I think you folks with your 10,000 stars, with how many open source repositories you have, it feels like you would move up very quickly in the in this ecosystem. And I think it is something you should look into because in the long term, a project like this is the thing that I think we could start to move the ball forward on what can actually contributing money to open source con like companies and open source contributors really could look like. So I don't know, I would encourage you to look into it more because I started to read their white paper, I got excited about it, and I'm like meaning to go back. And I think regardless of the fact that its usability sucks, because again, blockchain is just not there yet, I still think it's worth maybe investing that time. Because of what you're getting at. Like, yeah. Yeah, I think the other problem with this in particular is that it only counts projects that are distributed by package managers. So like the rankings that they do have to do with like how many times, NPM install or whatever. I'm blanking
Well,
out on it. By
isn't the Terraform or the Tofu registry, couldn't that be included into that
so
system?
it might be able to. I'm just saying, like right now, this particular, so go to that, like check my project T rank. I did this before. See that big button, Eric, down towards the bottom.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So start searching for like Atmos or something, and it only shows you. No, you can't put your that in there. Just type Atmos, because it's just by the package name that exists in a package manager. So that's how they rank, like, you know, that's
And
how they rank like everything in with like how many times it's been distributed
it doesn't
with.
even look like they're supporting like Golang. They're only supporting like PyPy
Yeah.
or NPM. So maybe the
Yeah.
protocol and the capabilities that it has today are not enough. And I don't even know if it's fully launched yet, but I think that's feedback to them,
Yeah.
because it's, yeah, really good to know that, hey, it's not actually supporting the projects that we're probably talking about here, but I
Yeah.
think there's something interesting there. Somebody in the comments asked, isn't this kind of like Gitcoin? And I don't know if Gitcoin is similar. Maybe worth looking into. See, that's supporting projects across Web3, which is not what I'm interested in.
I just, yeah, I want to bring it back to the real world.
Yeah.
The rest of us. So
Can someone pay us in like Minecraft dollars or whatever?
Matt, that reminds me, you shared this based on one of your it wasn't oh sorry the other Matt Gowie in this case, but I saw you shake nodding your head there, Matt, which is
No, I know this thing. I was shaking like recognition to this
yeah.
site.
So, initially I was very excited about it by the screenshots, but I was quickly kind of, I don't know, just frustrated with it. So I enabled it immediately for Cloud Posse. I wanted to kick the tires. It's been an area where, we've had for a long time our own reporting, but that system, it's another thing you got to keep up to date, and it has fallen behind. So I would love to see something like this. So I enabled it, had all my added all, 300 repositories, walked away, came back. Boy, this is not really telling me anything new that I didn't know. And then I quickly saw, oh, you've exceeded the free tier for this. And I just, screw it, I'm just gonna uninstall.
Yeah, damn.
And
Isn't this the other
when
way
I
though?
uninstall, I get a 502 server error. So I ended
Oh,
up
great.
GitHub and deleting it. So I don't know. I want to be bullish. I want to support, upstarts. Unfortunately, the experience rubbed me the wrong way. I'm just saying.
That's reasonable. Yeah. I was hoping it
But
would be
isn't
something
this?
that could be useful, but yeah.
I think this is the inverse of what we would want. This is showing you like the open source projects that you depend on. Right,
Oh, but
not
I.
the other way around.
Oh, and maybe that's why I was misunderstood. Anyways, I went to using their GitHub app, you can select which organizations you want to give it access to, and I gave it access to Cloud Posse, and I
Yeah.
selected all repositories, and then it went fanned out and collected a lot of the data. A lot of the problems with these things, which I understand are reasonable, it's just not reasonable for us. They're optimized for like individual repos because most open source projects are a handful of repos. You don't need the aggregate metrics. In our case, it's useless if unless I don't get aggregate metrics. I want to understand how we're doing the health of our open source organization. I want to see what the health is. How many overall stars are we adding? How many overall pull requests are we getting, and so forth. And it has some of that data here, but again, it didn't work because we hit some limit that they had. Maybe a reasonable limit, but if you're doing Terraform, it's an unreasonable limit if you use a lot of repositories.
So I found this out through a Denver DevOps Day like talk that was happening yesterday. The guy was talking about introducing LLM infrastructure into his Kubernetes cluster, and
He was just talking about the product a little bit, and it seemed like it might be of interest to Cloud Posse. I'll share this video with them and, let them know the feedback. I mean, why not, right? Like, hey, they are an
Yeah,
upstart, and
exactly.
they probably could use the, external perspective. I think Cloud Posse is pretty interesting in that, like, what other open source orgs are supporting 300 packages? That's a lot, and I think that it's unique, but that doesn't mean it's not valid feedback, and maybe there's something they could learn from you. Anyway, cool that you checked it out. Sorry it didn't work out.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing and passing it along. If anybody knows similar things, it'd be cool. Personally, I just want this in an SQL database that we can query with Metabase or similar tool to get the reports and the views of the data that we actually need to see. But shy of that, this is interesting as well. We've tried other things like Stitcher. They have a tap for ingesting GitHub. But again, all these things are optimized for a single repository. When you have hundreds of repositories, now you got to tap, tap, tap. You got to configure each one of those repositories to pull in the metrics, and don't want to do that either.
We could probably just set all of our webhooks to go to a Lambda and then just pull out the metadata and write them to SQL, to a SQL table, and be done.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be that hard.
Yeah. you're rehashing the old memory or sore memories here. Last year, what was it? Not this past Christmas, the Christmas before that, we got a $15,000 bill from Amazon on January 3rd because we switched to Redshift serverless, even though nothing was really running on it. It was misconfigured. The reason for that was we were using the webhooks in GitHub and forwarding all of them to Sitch Data, which was supposed to write them to our Postgres database, except for there's no way to create columns long enough to contain the like the normalized. If you take the JSON object and break it down into the path field, like foo.bar.x.z.y equals 200, that first part, the key, was too long to fit in an SQL database. Just doing it the naive way. Hey, take this whole webhook event and write it to a column or store on Postgres. That did not work. There are other solutions, of course. That did not work.
You can actually do it now to Postgres because they have native JSON support now as a data type.
Yeah, then there's we have to write a custom.
I know.
One quick thing. I don't know if you're familiar with OSS Insights. They, I think they're primarily a promotional service for ClickHouse, but they basically aggregate a bunch of data for you from GitHub. So you type in your username or your repo or maybe even your org. My understanding is their underlying data set is all publicly available. I forgot where it's at. Can't really find it.
I remember this. No, that's super cool. Okay, I gotta make
look. You would have to filter their dump for all the Cloud Posse related data, but I imagine you could do that as a batch job. So depending on how often you want to look at the data, run it once a month or once a week, and ideally it'd be cost effective for you. But
Hey, Eric.
Because I'm really skeptical that we've lost 1,900 stars while we've gained 2,400 pull requests. Seems the fact that everything is just has a cliff here.
Maybe it was moving things to your other org.
Not much has moved over, but it is cause for concern, something to look at.
Wait, it also says we have 7,000 packages. Right? Oh, no, activities. I see. Sorry. I misread what that said.
Very interesting. I'm making a note on that.
Did you end up getting AWS to refund you on that?
Oh, that, yes. Yeah.
Okay, cool. They did a full refund.
They did a full refund in the end on that. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. And we had to show that we put a lot of things in place to prevent it. And it went through multiple tiers of escalation. We had to show proof of like code changes and documentation and things like that. So they held us accountable. But after all of that, it was signed off and they gave us the.
We just had a client get billed like $4,500 extra dollars because there's a default in AWS Data Sync that is like actively malicious because it's very expensive. And they're trying to give us like a 20% refund. So I'm escalating it now. So I'm glad to hear that you had to go through the escalations to get the full refund. I'm hopeful that that'll happen for us, for our client as well. So we'll see.
Yeah, I guess it depends. You know, maybe they're discounting based on what the difference would have been if you had used that versus another setting, and maybe that price was just 20%. In this case, I think some of the extraneous factors were A, it was over Christmas and New Year's, and no one was in the office when this stuff was running, and like there was no traffic to it. Like it was just, I guess there was some provisioned capacity or something with the serverless. I don't know the term. With the Redshift database, but yeah, that just was insane how expensive it was.
Yeah, that's a crazy bill. I'm glad you got it fully refunded. Anyway, good to hear you did.
All right, next one. Covered that. Oh, also, you're able to send newsletters to your GitHub sponsors. Boy, we went on a roundabout loop there or talk. So that was also interesting. All right. So, Arc, if you're curious what browser I am.